Welcome to Tuesday Cafe. I'm Sean Canaan, and we are broadcasting live on April 2nd from the studios of WMNF in Tampa. Today we're going to hear an episode of a great show called Letters in Politics. This show is hosted by Mitch Jezerich, and we bring it to you every weekday afternoon at 6 o'clock on WMNF's HD3 channel, The Source. So if you like this show, I hope you tune in to The Source at 6 o'clock and hear Letters in Politics. Here's how you can listen to WMNF's HD3 channel, The Source. You can either listen on the WMNF Community Radio app, or you can go to WMNF.org and select The Source from the programming. Or if you have an HD radio, maybe in your car, you can listen to WMNF's HD3 channel, The Source. So at 6 o'clock on weekday afternoons, we play Mitch Jezerich's Letters and Politics. It's a great show. And in this episode that we're going to hear this morning, Mitch speaks with Therese Burden-Stelly. She's an associate professor of African American Studies at Wayne State University and a member of the Black Alliance for Peace Research and Political Education team. She's co-editor of the book called Organize, Fight, Win, Black Communist Women's Political Writing. And that book focuses on the black women in the Communist Party from 1919 to 1956. So I hope you enjoy. Send me an email, dj@wmnf.org, and let me know what you think, or if you have any other questions about how to listen to us on HD3, The Source.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics on today's show.
So the African Blood Brotherhood was founded by people like Richard B. Moore, Cyril Briggs, Grace P. Campbell, many of whom were Caribbean in origin. And they were basically what we would now refer to as like a revolutionary black nationalist organization. So they combined socialism with black liberation, right? This sort of pan-African black liberation consciousness. And they saw the Bolshevik Revolution as a sort of catalyst for an anti-imperial, anti-colonial kind of world proletariat, but with black people, African descended people sort of at the center of their analysis.
In the early 20th century, the African Blood Brotherhood would merge with the American Communist Party, making the CPUSA perhaps the most multiracial, anti-racist political organization in the country. Today, we're going to be in conversation about this history and focus on the black women in the party. Our guest is Therese Burden-Stelly. She has co-edited a new book called Organize, Fight, Win, Black Communist Women's Political Writing. It is the first of its kind, and she joins us to talk about it next on Letters in Politics. Good day and welcome to Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Today we're going to be in conversation about the black women writers and activists who were card-carrying members of the American Communist Party in the first half of the 20th century, a group of women who were instrumental in shaping the party, a party that was arguably the most multiracial, anti-racist political entity of its time. My guest today, along with Jody Dean, has compiled numerous writings from the likes of Williana Burroughs, Louise Thompson Patterson, Esther Cooper, Claudia Jones, and many others who were either in the party or working adjacent with the party, into the first of its kind of book that features solely the writings of black communist women. The book is called Organize, Fight, Win, Black Communist Women's Political Writing. My guest is Therese Burden-Stelly. Therese Burden-Stelly is Associate Professor of African American Studies at Wayne State University and a member of the Black Alliance for Peace Research and Political Education team. Therese Burden-Stelly, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio program.
Thank you for having me.
I really enjoyed preparing for our conversation. I've done many shows sort of referencing the Communist Party USA in the first half of the 20th century, never really dived into it itself. And then to learn about the role that there were many black women who were a part of this party and played a significant role and who wrote important pieces that you have compiled in this book, Organize, Fight, and Win. You focus on the years 1919 to 1956. What's important about those years?
Yeah, well, 1919 is important for a couple of reasons. That's sort of the formation of the first communist parties in the United States that later merged. But it's also the founding of the African Blood Brotherhood. So some of the earliest members of the Communist Party were founders of the African Blood Brotherhood. So somebody like Grace Campbell, for example, and later on in the early 1920s, the African Blood Brotherhood merged with the CP. And that is where they got a lot of their sort of Negro question work from. and a lot of the more sort of militant work and understanding of the Negro question. 1919 is also significant historically because this is, on the one hand, the time of like the Palmer Raids or the first Red Scare, when there was a massive deportation of foreign communists, anarchists, and socialists, primarily from Eastern Europe. It was also, you know, the Red Summer of 1919, where there were widespread race riots happening throughout the nation. And so it's in the context of post-World War I demobilization. So it's a really auspicious moment in that way. 1956 is important because this is when the so-called Khrushchev revelations came out, and there was a sort of massive exodus from the Communist Party. Some of the women that we write about left, some stayed. People like Louise Thompson Patterson, Esther Cooper Jackson, Marvel Cook all stayed, but many did leave. One of my favorite scholars who's not in here, his name is Doxie Wilkerson. He ended up leaving the party. It is also like the height of McCarthyism, what we might call like the long durée of McCarthyism. So it's after the classical McCarthyist period, which is typically 1951 and 1954, but it's still within the time of the sort of renewal of the McCarran Act. It's right after the passage of the Communist Control Act, which happened in 1954. So it's still in the height of intense anti-radical repression. And so those are the sort of two bookends. And that's kind of the, you know, in some ways, a classical period of the Communist Party. So that's why we focus there.
The African Blood Brotherhood. This would merge with the Communist Party of CPUSA. I don't know if it's called CPUSA at this time, but where does the African Blood Brotherhood come from?
So the African Blood Brotherhood was founded by people like Richard B. Moore, Cyril Briggs, Grace P. Campbell, many of whom were Caribbean in origin. And they were basically what we would now refer to as like a revolutionary Black nationalist organization. So they combined socialism with sort of Black liberation, right? This sort of Pan-African Black liberation consciousness. And they saw the Bolshevik Revolution as a sort of catalyst for an anti-imperial, anti-colonial kind of world proletariat, but with Black people, African descended people, sort of at the center of their analysis. Two of the best scholars on the ABB are Minka Makalani in his book in the Cause of Freedom, and then a lot of work by Winston James, up to and including Holding Aloft the Banner of Ethiopia. He also came out recently with a biography of Claude McKay that also covers some of this time period. And so, So those, if you want to know more about the ABB, those are good people to read about. Also the work of Bobby Hill. Those are people who write about it.
I said in my introduction that arguably the CPUSA would be the most multiracial, anti-racist political entity of its time. Let me know if I'm wrong on that, but does this merger that happens go a long way in explaining how that comes about?
Yeah, I think so. And I think because being a fundamentally anti-imperialist party, a party that is really dedicated to self-determination, must necessarily be sort of anti-racist, right? And I think this is not to say that there was not a lot of white chauvinism in the party, and that was an ongoing critique by Black women and Black men in the party, not only in the United States, but, you know, throughout the sort of the Black world or throughout the world. But I would say that they were the sort of, they never had integrated shops in their unions. They never sort of, they always put up Black people for vice presidential or presidential candidates, or they often had. So for example, James Ford, I think, was the first Black person to run for vice president. They always rhetorically conveyed a commitment to both interracial organizing, but also, Black equality. And then their sort of most radical stance, one might argue, on the Negro question is the Black Belt Nation thesis that comes about in 1928. It starts to be developed earlier than that, around 1922 and 1924. By 1928, it's more fully developed. This is something put forth primarily by Harry Haywood. And it goes through some revisions over time. It's moved away from in the 1930s during the reign of Earl Browder. then is brought back when William Z. Foster again becomes the head of the party. And there's a piece in our work by Claudia Jones called On the Right to Self-Determination for the Negro People in the Black Belt, where she's arguing that when the Communist Party took up the Black Belt, that made them at the very forefront of the struggle for Black liberation. And that put them at the forefront of sort of organizing around the Negro question. And so, that piece is a critique of so-called browderism and also a defense of Black self-determination.
Another important moment, and this is a little bit later after the formation of the in this merger, but it's in 1931, and it's a Scottsboro Boys case. This is when nine Black youths were wrongfully convicted of raping two white women in Alabama in 1931. Tell me about the Communist Party in this moment.
So it's interesting, right? We often mark the beginning of the civil rights movement in probably 1954 with the Montgomery bus boycott. But really we can trace probably the start of a particular type of method and methodology of the civil rights movement to the Scottsboro case. Because whereas the NAACP was primarily focused on litigation and winning a courtroom battle, the International Labor Defense, which was a sort of wing, a legal wing of the Communist Party, they were committed to not only winning particular courtroom battles, and it's important to note that there was some very important case law established through the litigation of like the ILD in collaboration with other organizations. So, for example, Powell v. Alabama, which has to do with fair jury selection, but their main contribution was mass organizing and mass protest and internationalizing the struggle and bringing the struggle outside of the courtroom because of the acknowledgement that these are capitalist courtrooms. This is capitalist jurisprudence, and the Scottsboro Boys are working. They're not only Black, they're also workers. And in the South, it's impossible to get a fair trial when you're Black and working class and being subjected to what I believe the ILD and maybe it later it was the CRC, the Civil Rights Congress, coined legal lynchings. So, and then they also brought this strategy to the Angelo Herndon case in 1932, to the Rosalie Ingram case in 1947, to the Trenton Six, Martinsville Seven, Willie McGee, these other important cases where they were organizing outside of the courtroom as well as waging these legal battles in order to raise people's consciousness, to internationalize the struggle, to educate workers on what was happening, and to build up a mass base for the defense of these people. And some of the cases were more successful than others. So all of the Scottsboro Boys, say one, eventually got out of prison. But Willie McGee and others actually did get put to death by the state.
Louise Thompson Patterson is one of the writers you feature in this book. She writes about the Scottsboro Boys. You have a chapter of that in your book. Does the Communist Party USA respond to this case because it already has significant Black membership?
I mean, I think that they respond because this is sort of right in the takeoff of the Great Depression. So I think they see it as a worker issue. They see it as a Black issue. They see it as later on they link the case to the invasion of Abyssinia in 1935 by Italian fascists, which then was later on linked to the Spanish Civil War. So there's a way that they understand the Scottsboro case as a enunciation of a U.S. brand of fascism that then gets linked to these other forms of fascisms that are playing out in Europe. And so I think that it's a combination of having Black members, but also understanding the significance of this case to working people, to working Black people, and to just people generally suffering under the Great Depression, that if this type of injustice can happen to nine boys who are on the train in the first place because they're looking for work, then it's not a far step to think that it can happen to anybody.
And is it the attention that's brought to this case that then makes, does this help grow membership for CPUSA, especially within the Black community?
Absolutely. So Claudia Jones and somebody like Queen Mother Audley Moore, who we don't include in the collection, they were drawn to the Communist Party because of the Scottsboro case, but also because of like the Harlem Tenements League and the type of organizing they were doing around housing and evictions, but all, and also around unemployment. But the Scottsboro case and then the work they're doing around the invasion of Ethiopia definitely drew Black people into the party. And in fact, that 1930s moment, I think, is the height of Communist Party membership for Black people.
That's interesting. Claudia Jones is somebody you find a lot in this book, and maybe is one of the more recognizable names. Tell me about Claudia Jones.
Yeah, so the best kind of source to read about Claudia Jones is Carol Boyce Davies' biography, Claudia Jones, Left of Karl Marx. There's also a collection that...
Left of Karl Marx.
Yeah, left, because she's Claudia Jones is literally buried to the left of Karl Marx in Highlands Cemetery in London. So it's metaphorical, but it's also like a literal location, which is something that Carol Boyce Davies actually introduced into like the, you know, the political imaginary that was the reality. Boyce Davies also edited Claudia Jones Beyond Containment, which is a collection of Claudia Jones's writings. And then there's a book by Marika Sherwood, Claudia Jones, A Life in Exile, that's more about Claudia Jones after she was deported in 1955 and her life in Britain. There's a book by Buzz Johnson called I Think of My Mother, which was actually the first kind of any type of engagement with Claudia Jones that was published, I think, in 1987. So anyway, Claudia Jones, she migrated to the United States and I want to say, or she was born in Trinidad, came to the United States and was a factory worker. And in fact, the work that she was doing in factories made her develop like a heart condition that she had her whole life, a condition that led to her premature death, I want to say in 1964. She was a member of the Young Communist League first, then moved on to become a member of the Communist Party, and then ultimately part of the leadership. She was one of the people who was indicted in a Smith Act trial. And I want to say it was the second round of indictments of the Communist Party leadership. Ultimately, she was convicted of attempting to overthrow the government by force or violence based on just writings by Karl Marx and writings on Lenin. They actually were not convicted of any overaction. It was all ideas. And she was ultimately deported in 1955. But she was a theoretician, an organizer, a leader in the party, and just somebody that I think really embodies the contributions that Black women made to the CP. She also was a theorist of triple oppression. She wasn't the first and she wasn't the only one, but her piece called An End to the Neglect of the Problems of the Negro Woman, which we don't have in this collection because it's widely available, is probably the most well-known theorizing of like triple oppression of Black women, which is the idea that Black women are oppressed as workers, as women, and as Black people. So it's a way of analyzing the relationship of Black women to their motive, to the capitalist mode of production, and also the social relations that emanate from that. So yeah, she's a great person to learn about. There's a lot of writing. There's a lot more writing about her now in the past sort of 5 to 10 years, which is, I think, is a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Left of Karl Marx. You don't hear that very often.
Right.
Was she close to Paul Robeson?
They did have a good relationship. You know, they both were sort of ground at the grist mill of anti-communism, if you will. And so they did have a good relationship. Paul Robeson. It's not historically clear if he was a member of the Communist Party. Most people would say yes, but that it was his membership in the party was intentionally kept a secret. But he was certainly a friend of the Communist Party, certainly a friend of the Soviet Union, was in organizations that in supportive of organizations like the Sojourners for Truth and Injustice that Claudia Jones belonged to. He is amazing in his own right, but they certainly had a great, strong relationship. And he in the book, the collection, Paul Robeson Speaks, he has some writings about, you know, defending her and trying to organize people against her deportation and against the Smith Act trials in general. So, yeah.
I had previewed that we'd be talking a little bit about Claudia Jones, and I had a listener write to me, ask if there was also a fallout between the two. I said I would ask that question.
I'm not familiar with that history. It's possible.
Yeah.
But everything that I've read, they've written fondly about each other. There could have been a fallout maybe around the China question. I'm not certain, because there is a way that Claudia Jones later in life moved to like a strong support of China. And in the context of the Sino-Soviet split, I don't know how, you know, Paul Robeson was staunch supporter of the Soviet Union. So it could have been over that, but that's speculation.
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's fair.
Yeah.
A term you have brought up a couple of times I wanted to ask you about, triple oppression. This is formulated through these writings within the Communist Party by black women in the first half of the 20th century. Tell me about this term, triple oppression.
Yeah, so there's this piece that a lesser known piece, well, there's many, but one of the earliest theorizations of triple oppression is 1936, Louise Thompson Patterson's Toward a Brighter Dawn. And then the sort of, it doesn't use the term directly, but a kind of case study in that is the 1935 piece, The Bronx Slave Market by Marvell Cook and Ella Baker. But there's a piece in 1950 that Vicki Garvin wrote called Union Leader Challenges Progressive America. And it's in Freedom Magazine, which is Paul Robeson's magazine. And she basically is talking about the conditions of black women. And so she writes, for example, if it is true, as has often been stated, that a people can rise no higher than its women, the Negro people have a long way to go before reaching the ultimate goal of complete freedom and equality in the United States. She goes on to talk about how black women are at the bottom of the economic ladder, how they're living under conditions reminiscent of the plantation era, especially as farmhands and in domestic service. They have low pay and terrible working conditions. And their pay is low even in the boom times, during the peak of World War II, that they disproportionately have to work outside the home in comparison to white women, and that, 85% of all Negro working class women were supporting families where the man of the house was missing. So basically, they have more sort of, so she writes broken homes, but, more sort of female headed households. And a lot of this has to do with the concentration of black women in the labor market because of the way that they're not represented in labor unions, because of the type of work to which they're reduced, because they're seen as like the mule of the world, as Zora Neale Hurston put it. But then she also talks about how Negro women have participated in militant struggles to win contracts and better working conditions, and that they, even if they are, have been historically overlooked when it comes to union organizing, they're making some of the most viable contributions. And, they're some of the best and most skilled organizers, not least because of their triple oppression. They have no other choice but to fight and to organize for better conditions and better pay.
This is Letters in Politics. Oh, no, please.
Oh, yeah. And so there's just, I just liked this line. She said, historically, it is the burning desire of every Negro woman to be free, to live and work in dignity on equal terms with all other workers. Negro women are eager to undertake a greater role to give substance to freedom and democracy, to help build an America of peace and abundance. So that just shows their commitment to sort of, their commitment to organizing against their own oppression is also a broader commitment to, worker struggle, proletarian struggle, and the struggle for political and economic democracy.
We're listening to an episode of Letters and Politics. It's hosted by Mitch Jezerich, and we bring it to you every weekday afternoon at 6 on WMNF's HD3 channel, The Source. This is Tuesday Cafe, coming to you from WMNF Tampa.
This is Letters and Politics, and we are in conversation with Therese Burden Stelly, Associate Professor of African American Studies at Wayne State University, and is also a member of the Black Alliance for Peace Research and Political Education team. She joins us for a conversation that she is the co-editor of a book about called Organize, Fight, Win, Black Communist Women's Political Writing. It is the first of its kind. That is a collection of Black Communist Women writings from the first half of, mostly the first half of the 20th century. You have a couple after 1950s, within the 1950s, which I guess would officially be the second half of the 20th century, but most of this in the first half of the 20th century. I was really fascinated by the attention that these women, that some, Esther Cooper would be an example of this, that put on domestic workers. She has a chapter in here called The Negro Woman Domestic Worker in Relation to Trade Unionism. In the last, couple decades, we've had a very vibrant movement of domestic workers. I think of Domestic Workers United, which I think was its former name, that came out of New York City. And this idea that, you know, from the 1930s and the New Deal, that farm workers and domestic workers, who were mostly African-American workers at the time, were left out of the labor protections created in the New Deal. And I always felt like this was a movement that, you know, sort of has been around for the last 20 years. But from your book, I have learned that this was a big issue even in its time when this first started happening.
Yeah. So as early as 1930, Williana Burroughs is talking about domestic workers, and even before that, but 1930. So that's, you know, a full sort of 10 years before Esther Cooper Jackson's. So that what we provide in there is an excerpt from her master's thesis that she did at Fisk University. And her whole master's thesis was about organizing domestic workers. And so part of what Williana Burroughs is arguing, and there's three reports on Negro women. She's talking about how the party has not done a great job of winning domestic workers into the party. And that's unfortunate because the bulk of Negro women, she writes, are still in the South, where a large number work on the land or work in domestic service. They're some of the most exploited workers. They have the worst working conditions. They're the most exploited. They're not covered by any labor protection. And then she goes on to connect this to domestic workers around the world, right? So she talks, for example, about, she says, domestic workers are the next largest category among colored women. As general house workers, they slave 14 to 16 hours a day for $10 to $12 a week in America, for 3 to 8 months in the southern states and in the West Indies, and for less than 25 cents a day in all parts of Africa. So this phenomenon of Black women domestic workers is a diasporic one, it's an international one. And so part of what she's arguing, ultimately, first of all, she offers an analysis of their conditions, the social relations to which they're subjected because of their sort of economic position. And then she offers up, you know, she talks about how the party has a historical task or responsibility to draw more of these women to the party, to organize these women, and to center their struggle because of, if you only look at, for example, like the white male industrial worker, there's a whole swath of laborers who are being left out of that organizing and analysis. And the poor wages of these particular super exploited workers drive the wages of everybody down. And so, you know, she's putting this analysis in relationship to the sort of forced labor, expropriation of land, death rates, and child labor in the African colonies. And so it's a broad based analysis of imperialism and of the way that Black women in particular suffer under imperialism, one manifestation of which is their relegation to this very exploitative domestic service.
So there's a very strong international aspect to these writings, and again aimed at imperialism. Tell me more about the approach towards imperialism.
So imperialism is really the basis for triple oppression. So often people ask me about triple oppression versus intersectionality. And part of what, you know, my understanding is that triple oppression is objectively anti-imperialist. It's a way of analyzing the intersection of oppression and exploitation under an imperialist system, with imperialism being the highest stage of capitalism. And it's an analysis of also how imperialism operates internally, because in the context of the United States, there's a particular type of imperial relationship between the U.S., the industrialized North, and the agrarian, or what they call semi-feudal South. And this is not least because of the concentration of Black people in the U.S. South. And so imperialism is a system, it's the political economy through which the oppression of Black people is experienced. Imperialism is the basis of the Black Belt Nation thesis. It's the basis of the demand for self-determination. It's the way that communists put the struggle of Black people in the United States in conversation with or in relationship to struggles that are happening globally. And so I think imperialism is the basis of all of that analysis, because imperialism is an internationalist system, and so the analysis is necessarily internationalist. Imperialism necessitates an analysis of capitalism, because it's the highest stage of capitalism. It's a particular epoch, if you will, of capitalism. Imperialism also necessitates an analysis of colonialism, which is, according to somebody like Walter Rodney, is a sort of political form of imperialism. Imperialism is an economic relation, whereas colonialism is a sort of the political foundation. And then an analysis of colonialism, embedded in that is an analysis of racism and white supremacy. And so imperialism is the basis of all of these forms of analyses, and also the sort of the fulcrum around which all of these different systems come together.
And triple oppression is not intersectionality.
No. So intersectionality is sort of, I guess, maybe a framework for understanding identity. Triple oppression, which is also sometimes referred to as triple exploitation, is a way of understanding like the sort of imperialist foundations of Black women's economic and political position. One of the major differences that, you know, I talk about is that with intersectionality, it started out in terms of its coining by Kimberly Crenshaw as a legal analysis. It was about recognition before the law. And within U.S. jurisprudence, class is not a protected category because it's a class society. And so even in the race, class, gender nexus that is often put forth as intersectionality, class is generally underdeveloped because it's not part of the original theorizing. The original theorizing has to do with race, the way that race and gender, somebody at the intersection of race and gender can't be recognized before the law. When it comes to discrimination. And that's the other thing. Intersectionality is really about kind of discrimination so it's more so about sort of discrimination, whereas triple oppression is about oppression and exploitation. So even though the what might seem similar, the so what is different, and the politics are different. And so intersectionality is primarily liberal. It can be harnessed to anti-imperialist ends, but it's not objectively anti-imperialist, whereas triple oppression as a mode of analysis is, and as a politics is necessarily anti-imperialist.
You mentioned a few times the Black Belt thesis. What is that?
Mm-hmm. So the Black Belt thesis was really, it's sort of, first real codification was in 1928. It was a thesis put forth by Harry Haywood and a South African and Soviet comrade that basically stated that Black people are a nation, that Black people in the Black Belt, the U.S. South, which is five contiguous states that contains over 100 counties in which Black people are the numerical majority, and that's the base of the Black Belt is the base of the Black nation. Drawing on this kind of Stalinist notion of a nation where there is a common language, culture, landmass, and some other characteristics. And so it was argued that Black people fit that specification. And so what this meant is that Black people had the right to self-determination in the Black Belt up to and including seceding from the United States if they so chose. It was a controversial thesis. A lot of Black communists did not agree with the Black Belt Nation thesis because they thought it sort of reinscribed segregation or reinscribed a particular Jim Crow logic. But to me, the relevance and importance of the Black Belt thesis is, number one, the argument that Black people's oppression is national in character. It's not discrimination. It's not simple exclusion. It's not the same experience as the white hyphenates would experience. So Polish American or Italian American. It's national in character. That's akin to the ways that people in the colonies are oppressed, and which has to do with the way that surplus value is extracted from Black people in those areas. And secondly, part of what the Rise of the Black Belt Nation thesis did, which Robin Kelly sort of documents in Hammer and Hoe, is that it shifted the focus to the South, or it built up the work of the Communist Party in the South and really pushed the Communist Party to expand who counted as a worker. So to focus on peasant workers, so sharecroppers, agricultural workers, people who weren't just in industry, and then also workers who are located in the South. And so that's what's really important about the Black Belt Nation thesis, whether or not one agrees with the validity of whether Black people are a nation in the sort of Leninist or Stalinist sense, yeah, is a little bit immaterial. It's more so about the content of the work that was done under the rubric of Black self-determination, and also a real understanding of how Black people are treated in this country.
The Communist Party's presence in the South is fascinating. I don't know if most, I think most people just assumed this was a Northern thing.
Mm-hmm. So again, I think that Robin Kelly has some of the best writing on this. Yeah. Minka Makalani's book that I mentioned talks about this, especially through the American Negro Labor Congress and the League of Struggle for Negro Rights, which by and large were sort of, especially the League of Struggle for Negro Rights, were kind of paper organizations. But these were ways for the Communist Party to really take up the Negro question in a revolutionary way, because their initial approach, according to people like Winston James and even George Padmore, who was a member of the Communist Party for a time, was that the strategy of the Communist Party prior to 1928 was try to capture a section of the Garvey movement and to infiltrate the UNIA, mm-hmm, and to sort of lop off a section of those, or, you know, get as many of those workers as possible to join the Communist Party. But they were like incredibly unsuccessful at that approach. And so part of their developing their own sort of position on the Negro question, their position on Black people as a nation, was sort of engaging with the nationalist sentiment of Black workers at that time, but giving it a revolutionary thrust as opposed to a sort of petty bourgeois thrust. And the development of the American Negro Labor Congress was also in the service of sort of doing that organizing work. You know, Minka Makalani has a critique of that and the sort of the seriousness or lack thereof that the Communist Party, as opposed to the Communist International, treated that work. But it's very important. And as you mentioned earlier, like, irrespective of what, you know, people want to say about the Communist Party, they were the most progressive party when it came to race relations, probably before or since, right? And so that's facts. In fact, there's a piece by Williana Burroughs that is, by Grace Campbell, House of the Negro Vote, that's actually really important. It's from 1928. And so I just want to read this little part from it where she sort of makes this claim.
And this is in the book.
This is in the book, right? And so this is from 1928, and it's light years ahead of where we are now. What she says is, the Democratic and Republican parties have been in power through Negro votes since the close of the Civil War. Negroes have voted for both parties during the long period. Out of Democratic and Republican administrations alike have come Jim Crowism, mobbing, segregation, lynching, Southern disenfranchisement, and general terrorism. Lack of opportunity of making a living in poor educational facilities. At the same time, a stamp of inferiority has been placed on all Negro people. This is the past record of the capitalist parties. In the present campaign, they promise nothing better. Only the Workers' Communist Party stands for full social and racial equality, equal opportunity to earn a living, fair and square treatment before the courts of law, and general racial emancipation.
We're listening to an episode of Letters in Politics hosted by Mitch Jezerich. We bring it to you every weekday afternoon at 6 on WMNF's HD3 channel, The Source. It's all news and public affairs 24 hours a day. You're listening to Tuesday Cafe, coming to you from WMNF Tampa. Here's more of the interview.
Therese Burden Stelly, tell me where do these writings come from that's a part of this book, Organized Fight, Win? Again, this is a collection of Black communist women's political writings, mostly from the first half of the 20th century. Where do these writings come from, and how are you able to get to them?
Mm-hmm. So a lot of the writings I sort of had from, I spent a lot of time in archives. I'm not a historian, but I like to say I'm historically nosy. So I spent a lot of time in archives. So I've got some of the documents from like the CPUSA papers at the Tamament, from Louise Thompson Patterson's paper at the Woodruff Library at Emory, from the Claudia Jones papers at the Schomburg, various other collections. And so I had some of those primary documents, but this was a very, very collective project. So a lot of people helped us. So LaShawn Harris was really helpful. She sent me like four huge envelopes of articles and documents by and about Marvell Cook from some of her research she had done. Eric Gelman, who wrote a book about the Southern Negro Youth Congress, sent things. Eric McDuffie was helpful. Melissa Ford was helpful. Andrew Gregg, who wrote a book about Tyra Edwards. So I just kind of emailed these people and kind of asked them about what they had. And Amika Makalani was actually super helpful. All of the writing, those early writings in that first section, he sent us that he got from the Soviet archives. And so
the Soviet archives.
There were things. Yeah, when it was first opened. And so these were things that, and these had not previously been collected. He went for his work on his dissertation, but he gave us a lot of them. Jody got some of the other ones from interlibrary loan. So just looking through different databases, because we were collecting these primarily during the pandemic, so in throughout 2020, and so she was able to get some from interlibrary loan. So the documents came from a lot of different places, and then there's a lot of stuff from Freedom newspaper, because Freedom is fully digitized by the New York Public Library. So the tenement, I believe, they fully digitized the Freedom newspaper. So we have columns, for example, from Alice Childress, Islanda Robeson, Lorraine Hansberry, et cetera, that come from Freedom newspaper.
What was Freedom newspaper?
So Freedom newspaper was founded by Paul Robeson and Louis Burnham, I believe, in 1950. It was short-lived because it was plagued with financial issues, not least because it was targeted by the U.S. government. And it was amazing. It was like one of the earliest papers to publish about apartheid, the anti-apartheid struggle. It was very internationalist in scope. There's stuff about Egypt and Zambia. They published about the Sojourners for Truth and Justice when they were formed in 1951, which we have some writings from that organization in our collection. It was an all Black women's organization, multi-tendency, but with a lot of Communist Party members. They had this fiction column about a domestic worker named Mildred by Alice Childress. We have a couple of those pieces, and that's really interesting, right? Because it challenges us to stretch our idea of where theory and knowledge production come from, right? By including things like this fictionalized column. Freedom was just really important. It was a place where a lot of early culture workers like Lorraine Hansberry, Alice Childress, and Bay Richards kind of cut their teeth at short stories and poetry and plays and we're able to infuse their culture work with politics. So and Freedom came out of just this sort of cadre of Black leftists who were committed to Black liberation. They were at Black liberation and socialism. They were part of organizations like the Council on African Affairs, the Civil Rights Congress, the National Committee to Defend Negro Leadership, and other types of left-wing interracial and Black organizations. And so Freedom was really important. It was short-lived, but it's a treasure trove. And so I highly recommend people to visit that digitized archive.
I want to ask you one of the later pieces of writings that you have in this book, and it's actually a speech, and it's called The Acceptance Speech of Mrs. Bass. This is Charlotta Bass, who in 1952 was her acceptance speech was went for the nomination of vice president with the Progressive Party. Tell me about Charlotta Bass.
Yeah, Charlotta Bass is awesome. She was a newspaper editor of the California Eagle, which was a Progressive Party. She wasn't a member of the Communist Party. And then some people who are doing work on her also say she has some sort of anti-communist tendencies. I didn't find that in my research, because she worked a lot with the Communist Party. She was treated as a communist, as most progressives were, right? Because anybody who was willing to work with the Communist Party was called before the House Committee on Un-American Activities, were red-baited, were hounded by the government, etc. But, you know, the California Eagle was a very progressive paper. It was, you know, anti-lynching, a very good critique of the Korean War, for example. And she was, her and her husband were the founders of that newspaper, and she was an editor for a long time. She also was the first woman to run for vice president, and that was in for the Progressive Party in, I want to say, 1952.
That's when the speech is, yeah.
Yeah, and so she's a really important figure as a journalist, and the role of journalism in political education and in consciousness raising. And then she just was a part of everything. She was a signatory of We Charge Genocide. She had a good relationship with Paul Robeson and W.B. Du Bois and William Patterson and those types. And so she's a really important historical figure. There's actually a really good oral history of her. I believe that was done through Smith College. They did a lot of these oral histories with people like Barbara Smith, and I believe Charlotta Bass is one of them. So again, if you want to know more information, she also has a memoir called like 40 years as editor of the California Eagle or something. But if you just Google Charlotta Bass memoir, it's a sort of memoir through articles that were published in the California Eagle. So that's a really good resource as well.
And an important person. You said first woman to run for vice president.
Absolutely.
And I learned of her name from your book. I had never heard her. And I like to pride myself on knowing a little bit of history. I'm not a historian either, but yeah, I haven't heard many of these names before I got to your book, including Louise Thompson Patterson, Grace Campbell, Williana Burroughs. A little bit about Claudia Jones, but I did not know a lot about her. I mean, you're sort of bringing to light with this book a lot of names that were not known, including by a lot of leftists.
Mm-hmm. In fact, like, you know, something that I forgot to do that me and Jody like to do when we start interviews is just read the names of all the people who are collected here. So we have Ella Baker, who a lot of people probably know, who was not in the Communist Party, but she wrote the piece with Marbel Cook and was sort of around progressive circles. We had Charlotta Bass, Dorothy Burnham, who is still alive, by the way.
Really?
Liana Burroughs. Yep. Grace P. Campbell, Alice Childress, Marbel Cook, Esther Cooper Jackson, who just died in August 2022 at the age of 105. Thelma Dale Perkins, Tyra Edwards, Vicki Garvin, Yvonne Gregory, Lorraine Hansberry, Dorothy Hunton, Claudia Jones, Maude Whitecaps, Louise Thompson Patterson, and Islanda Good Robeson. So the other interesting thing, too, is not just people, like, not just presenting people that no one has heard of, but also revealing the radical politics of other folks. So, for example, the other night I did a panel at the Young Communist League, and one of the attendees is like a kind of an actress and a playwright, and she had known of Alice Childress because I guess she had the first play on Broadway or something. She was the first Black woman to have a play on Broadway. She didn't know, like, Alice Childress was super radical, right? And that a lot of, you know, her culture work was honed and developed through, like, the pages of Freedom newspaper. Somebody like Lorraine Hansberry, all people really know about her is, like, Raising in the Sun and Perhaps to Be young, Gifted, and Black. But she was also extremely radical. Paul Robeson was a close mentor of hers. She was very integral to Freedom newspaper. And so it's also interesting to sort of recuperate those narratives from, like, intellectual McCarthyism, which either erases people altogether or sanitizes them, like they do with, like, MLK, for example, sanitizes them to the point where you think that they're, like, just liberals. So
tell me a little more about the intellectual McCarthyism and just what happens in the 1950s and what happens to the CP USA, the Communist Party USA, and sort of where in sort of the splitting up of the party, where do the Black women who are part of the party at this time go?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so intellectual McCarthyism is just kind of a term that I made up, I guess. It's a broader phenomenon that talks about the ways that sort of people, radicals generally, but Black radicals particularly, are either erased, they're marginalized in histories, or they're sanitized. So, for example, if you take somebody like W.B. Du Bois, we know about, you know, Souls of Black Folk, but we know nothing. We don't know that he joined the Communist Party in 1961 before he left the United States and, like, moved increasingly to the left. He himself said, "It's as if I died in 1903. He lived for 60 years after that and was and moved sort of progressively to the right, went to the Soviet Union many times, to China, et cetera. And so intellectual McCarthyism is sort of that attempt to make it seem as if, like, all the radicals are white and all the Blacks are liberals, but more than that, to just sort of decimate or illegitimate any type of history, any type of radical history. So it seems that only voting for the Democrats, only representation and recognition, those are the only paths that we have of struggle. And so people will know, for example, about the NAACP and Thurgood Marshall, but they'll know nothing about William Patterson, who was extraordinarily important to civil rights, or the Civil Rights Congress. The Civil Rights Congress coined the term civil rights. And so, and also the way that these radicals were organizing for human rights right? They understood civil rights as a function of human rights. And then that gets disciplined out to just talk about sort of inclusion in American society through the law. So anyway, so that's intellectual McCarthyism. But in terms of McCarthyism as a sort of political, as a mode of, or a form of anti-communist governance, basically what happened was the Communist Party and any adjacent organizations would be infiltrated. Paid informants by the FBI. They'll be called, you know, members will be called before the House Committee on Un-American Activities, the Subversive Activities Control Board, the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee. They would be decimated financially. People would be sent to prison. Like Alpheus Hunton, for example, got sent to prison for contempt because he wouldn't turn over the list of donors. And so there was really no Fifth Amendment protection against self-incrimination, because if you invoke the Fifth Amendment, you were assumed to be guilty popularly, right? And you could be fired from your job. You were blacklisted from getting jobs. You would be kicked out of mainstream organizations, like the NAACP had a very strong, the national body had a very strong sort of anti-communist focus where they try to kick out anybody that was thought to be communist. A. Philip Randolph's March on Washington movement was made to be explicitly black precisely because he was saying that that's a way to keep communists out, which is an acknowledgement that communists were anti-racist and interracial, right? So so it's not just it's a top down, that McCarthyism, right, or this anti-communism, is a top down and a bottom up phenomenon. And it's all three branches of government. And so I have a book coming out actually in November called Black Scare, Red Scare, that kind of explores this in depth. But basically, all like this sort of anti-communism from all levels and from different levels of intensity just really kind of it crushed the Communist Party in a certain way. But as Dale Gore writes in her book, Radicalism at the Crossroads, it's not as if people just fell out of existence. So, for example, Marvell Cook and Louise Thompson Patterson were integral to the Free Angela Davis Committee in the 1970s. William Patterson and Louise Thompson Patterson were some of the early mentors to the Black Panther Party. Louise Thompson Patterson she continued to write and speak, and her daughter, actually Mary Louise Patterson, is a really important organizer and activist in her own right, a revolutionary doctor. But so a lot of these women continued to do work. Some of them shifted ideologically. A lot of them sort of pivoted toward like a black feminist politic that was still pretty radical, revolutionary. Some people left the Communist Party and kind of pivoted toward a Maoism or China. So Vicky Garvin is one of those people. She left the United States, first going to Nigeria, then to Ghana, and ultimately to China. And so there was a variety of approaches, but many of the women stayed, right? Kept those ties. So somebody like Dorothy Hunton, who I don't believe was ever a member of the Communist Party. She was the wife of Alpheus Hunton, who was a member, but she kept her ties with various members in the Communist Party. And, you know, in her memoir of Alpheus Hunton, which we include some excerpts from there, that was published in the 1980s, she holds on to sort of the critique of McCarthyism and the importance of the Communist Party and Alpheus Hunton's role in it to a lot of the liberation struggles that were happening throughout the 30s through the 50s, even at the height of McCarthyism.
Therese Burden-Stelly has been our guest again. Therese Burden-Stelly, Associate Professor of African American Studies at Wayne State University, a member of the Black Alliance for Peace Research and Political Education team. And she is the co-editor, along with Jody Dean, of the book that she has joined us to talk about. It's called Organize, Fight, Win, Black Communist Women's Political Writing. Therese Burden-Stelly, that was fascinating, and I thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
That does it for Letters on Politics. The show is produced by Deanna Martinez. Kirsten Thomas is our engineer. If you'd like to hear this or past shows, you could do so by going online and finding our archives at kpfa.org. I'm Mitch Jesrich, and I thank you for listening.
Hope you found that interesting. You can listen to Letters and Politics every weekday afternoon at 6 on WMNF's HD3 channel, The Source. And if you're heading to Pinellas County, from Pinellas, that is, to Hillsborough, you might want to avoid the Howard Franklin Bridge. The three left lanes are blocked on northbound I-275 at the beginning of the bridge there. Looks like the accident might have been cleared by now, but there is still some backups. You've been listening to Tuesday Cafe. I'm Sean Canaan, and during this time slot tomorrow, Gary Gibbons will guest host Midpoint. Coming up next is Wavemakers with Janet and Tom Scherberger. Their Wavemaker is Matthew Lowe, Executive Director of the Global Kratom Coalition, an industry group pushing for more regulation. This is Tuesday Cafe on WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota.